You're listening to Neurodiversity at Work.
Life can be so shady. The way some people try to bring you down. Why's it got to be so crazy? Always trying to give you the run around.
Adam, welcome to the podcast. Pleased to have you on. Would you like to introduce yourself to our audience, let them know who you are, what you do?
Sure. Thank you very, very much for having me on. I really, really appreciate that. My name is Adam Corey. I am training as a teacher at the moment, and I also speak publicly about neurodiversity. I'm dyspraxic myself, and I've spoken at the civil service. I've spoken at some high profile conferences in the world of advertising and marketing, and I'm just sort of an area that just fascinates me. I'm a real kind of student of it, and it's something that just I just keep researching and keep learning about all the time, like a lot of us. I think it's just an area that's growing and it's going to continue to do so.
That's interesting, Adam. I don't often get the opportunity to talk with people from a student perspective. And I did some research with somebody I know called Mills and an organisation called Tappin. And basically, the research told us that only 1% of students who weren't neurodiverse understood what neurodiversity was, the concept. So on that basis, and I mean, you are, so it probably makes more sense to you. What is your view of neurodiversity? And I guess also, you know, what does it mean to you? And what is your perception across, I guess, your network, your age demographic of what your friends and people that you know think?
So, I mean, I'm not a student at a university or anything like that. I graduated quite a long time ago. But I, when I say a student, I feel like I've become a student of this area, this topic.
Yes.
But certainly, you know, I think that when I was training as a teacher, part of my course is through the UCL. And I think that they do try quite hard, their disability services, to help students as much as possible. But I think there are huge gaps there, just because they're pretty overwhelmed with the amount of stuff they've got going on, the amount of help they're offering to different students from around the world. And I felt that it was quite difficult to get the kind of specific support in place while I was doing my placements at schools. And I think that it's something that a lot of students probably, you know, if you're an undergraduate, for example, a lot of them wouldn't know that they were neurodiverse. Some would, I guess, if they were diagnosed earlier at school, but many wouldn't. And so I think that there are huge challenges there. I guess in terms of, you know, being a student of this topic, it's something that I'm just reading about all the time, watching YouTube videos, TED Talks. I've been reading some great books about different styles of thinking, different management techniques that kind of incorporate neurodiversity, and it's just an area that I think that the smart businesses are really kind of getting on top of, but there's still a long way to go. And I think that for somebody who's neurodiverse, it can be an uphill struggle in a lot of organizations.
Definitely. So from a teacher's perspective then, what is the training adequate from a neurodiversity perspective? Is it even considered from your experience going through that process? Obviously, you've been empowering yourself with the information as a student of neurodiversity. But do you think there's enough out there yet to support teachers for the reality that, you know, maybe 20% of that classroom might be neurodiverse?
No, I don't think there is. It's never that we did have specific sessions on SEN, teaching children with specific educational needs and children who maybe didn't have English as their first language. But there was nothing specific to, you know, this huge variety of neurodiversity that the area of neurodiversity encompasses. There was nothing specific towards, you know, how to teach some kid who's dyslexic, you know, how to approach somebody with, you know, a child with ADHD, that there was nothing tailored, at, you know, at that level. And it was very much based on, you know, you're going on help from experienced teachers, maybe some reports that you read from kind of external agencies, perhaps. But there was very little in the way of training to help these children specifically. I think that it, you know, that is an area that needs to be addressed.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, our SEN teacher has been very supportive, but actually we've had to do a lot of proactive work. And sometimes, you know, I feel like we, and probably because it's our child, right? We definitely have a lot more information than they have and a lot of insight, which is okay. And it's about sharing of knowledge and information and experience. So yeah, I absolutely buy into that. And I think there needs to be more accountability at the top to ensure that teachers are better informed, I think, and that they have the time, which is probably laughably non-existent, isn't it, for teachers at the moment?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the pressure, the accountability levels are really, really high in teaching, and there is no you are really, I mean, certainly in the first few years, it's very much a case of planning, teaching, marking, and basically surviving. That's really what it kind of boils down to. Once you get past a certain period, it does become easier, and you may have that opportunity to kind of look deeper into some of these issues. But I think that, you know, many of the teachers that you find in schools at the moment are teachers that just don't have, you know, that many years of experience because of the challenges, because of the pressures that, you know, they're involved in that role, and the lack of budget as well. That's a big thing, that most schools don't have a budget, and they may not be able to kind of pay the kind of salaries that really I think teachers deserve. And so that means that more schools, more state schools anyway, are, you know, will have teachers that are just inexperienced. And I think that, you know, I used to work for a private learning centre that did specialise actually in helping children with dyslexia. And the approach was just very, very different. And it's not something that most teachers would have an experience of. And it's a real shame.
How did you find out that you were neurodiverse then? At what point in your life and did you get the required support needed?
Yeah, it's an interesting one. So originally I trained as a journalist, and I had a tutor. One of the tutors there, we had to learn shorthand. I don't know if you know much about shorthand. It's got like the old school kind of style of you're taking notes in court and, you know, yeah, doing interviews and that sort of thing. It's kind of like shapes that represent letters. And I just couldn't copy the shapes down properly from the board. I kept doing, you know, I kept copying it down the wrong size or just not accurately. And it was just a complete mess. And my tutor thought that I was dyslexic, and I started looking it up, and I was saying, no, that's not quite it. And then I started looking up at the other areas of neurodiversity and stumbled across dyspraxia, and I thought, you know, shit, that is it. And that's a real sort of light bulb moment. And it's one where, I don't know how you felt when you were diagnosed or whatever, but I think that for me, it was one of relief. It kind of explained a lot of things that you couldn't explain beforehand. Suddenly things start to make sense in your life, but also a bit of kind of like annoyance or anger in some way that hadn't, you know, why hadn't my teachers picked up on it at school? You know, why hadn't my parents? But, you know, kind of like, you know, a real mixture of emotions. And it was quite a, yeah, strange time.
Yeah, that's interesting, because I had a similar experience of 21, diagnosed with dyslexia at university, and only, you know, diagnosed with ADHD at 38. So I feel exactly the same way, that it's, you know, there's a level of frustration there, but actually a realisation, that's why I feel in this way, that's why I'm affected in this way, and, you know, I'm not stupid, or I'm not an angry person, or whatever it is, however it manifests itself from a negative perspective, it lifts a great burden from you, which I think is just so empowering, so helpful, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. It's kind of like the guiding sort of path to help you find, you know, a career or a way of working that works for you. And until you kind of have that, it can be very, very difficult to explain and to understand. And particularly, you know, if you're thinking about jobs and that sort of thing, if you're looking for reasonable adjustments, being able to confidently explain that to an employer, I think is really important. If you haven't got that information, or if you don't know how to do that, that it's going to be an uphill struggle, I think. So certainly, yeah, it helped to explain a lot of things in my life, and you know, things that just didn't make sense, like being in jobs where, you know, I could sort of write really, really well and that sort of thing, as you know, as a journalist, and then really struggled to, you know, in other roles before that, when I'd worked in like a shop and couldn't operate the till because I just, you know, that's just not how my brain worked. And, you know, all those kind of things where you're just thinking, how come I could do that? But I just couldn't do that at all. So things did start to make sense after that.
It's that spiky profile that is discussed, that shared around, you know, and I think that describes it so well, that you can be really, really great at something and struggle with something else that's so simple. And it's just so confusing, and it can feel soul destroying to feel like you're not able to do something that for other people is such a simple task. And I think that can have a hugely negative impact on your mental health, well-being, and on your confidence. And if you allow it to get to you, then it can really affect your career and what you do in life and relationships and what have you. Yeah. So, Adam, you mentioned that you speak at a wide variety of events. What is it that you're passionate about? What area of neurodiversity, or how are you describing it? What is it that you're often sharing when you speak?
Yeah, so in the past I've sort of shared my own personal experiences, but also I've kind of got a presentation together that I put together for the Ministry for Local Government Housing just before the lockdown, actually. And yeah, as you mentioned, the spiky profile thing is something that I include, and it's an area that I think really, really interested people when speaking to kind of managers about this. Now that's a really important kind of thing to show them, I think, if they're managing somebody who's neurodiverse, but also picking up on, you know, people who may be in the public eye or may not be in the public eye, but kind of challenge stereotypes of, or how you might perceive somebody who's, you know, in my case, dyspraxic to be. So I sometimes use an example of a rugby player who's an England international, actually, who's dyspraxic. And you know, when you think about some of the challenges that you'd associate with dyspraxia, you know, not being very well coordinated, struggling to do, you know, to be able to kind of fight, use space correctly, or all those kind of things where, you know, you'd assume they would struggle in. You know, these people kind of buck the trend. And I think that it can be, it's an interesting thing because, you know, although there are strengths and challenges that are associated with each of these areas of neurodiversity, it's important that we don't make assumptions, and to understand that people can challenge them and can get better over time. They may need longer to learn new skills. They may have to learn it in a different way, but we shouldn't make assumptions.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's too easy to assume, for example, that somebody with autism is not going to be confident and not going to like to engage with people and be shy and reserved and have issues with speech. And it's just absolutely not the case. For many, you know, they have different strengths in a wide variety of areas. You know, it's the fingerprint, the thumbprint, isn't it, of that we are all very different, so that you can't pigeonhole us, even those who I guess how the word neurodiversity is now defined, those people who sit at the 20% of being significantly different in terms of the way their brains work.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I think that's what makes it also really challenging for a manager, you know, for somebody. I think it requires real, I think, emotional intelligence, and being able to kind of really get the best out of people requires really, really good managers who are really well trained. To be able to get the best out of people who may or may not fit a profile and often don't. And I think that, you know, this is something that organizations are really kind of grappling with. And I think that, you know, some are way ahead of others. The civil service, I think, is one that is ahead of a lot of organizations. But I think that it's partly to do with resources, right? They've got resources that, you know, small organizations may not have. And that can make a big difference. But yeah, I think it's something that the organizations need to be much more aware of. And you were speaking before about in Germany, how this is an area that's kind of fallen behind, and a lot of companies, a lot of organizations there. So I think it's, you know, there isn't a kind of standard practice. And I don't think that, and I think that there are still a lot of areas that need to be worked on there.
Yeah, and when you mention organisations that are doing well, I think if we look at the new generations coming through, Generation Y, and you've got Generation Z, you know, the workforce, you've got, I mean, there's some research being done by Universum, and they show that Generation Y wants the work-life balance. They want an organisation that's going to be more caring and considerate to them. And then you've got Generation Z who want belonging. You know, they want to be cared for and looked after and want to feel a part of something. And I think if we consider that around neurodiversity, there is a wonderful opportunity for government, public organisations to actually focus on this, because they do potentially have better resources and time and commitment, and they are more committed to, I guess, diversity, inclusion and belonging more broadly by nature of what they do. Yeah. So there is I think there's a great opportunity for those types of organisations to kind of really get hold of neurodiversity as a concept and start to make an impact, because big organisations like tech companies like IBM and similar organisations, Microsoft, and what have you, have started programs because they recognize the incredible capability of some people who are neurodiverse as developers to see patterns, to be able to follow rigid kind of processes or whatever it may be. Same thing again and again and again as a tester. But it's much bigger than that. The opportunity is much bigger. So what other organisations do you think, are there any others that you've observed that perhaps are not, that people maybe wouldn't think of immediately?
I know that Direct Line have been doing some a lot of work in this area, and I know that there are a few others that are not necessarily in the tech space. I know what you mentioned before, a lot of the focus has been on autism, and I think that broadening that up, widening that up has been a real is still a real challenge. And I think that say Direct Line, I know that they've done a lot of work in terms of helping some of their dyslexic members of staff, and I think that there are a few others, but it's patchy, isn't it? I think, and I still think there's an overall huge focus on autism, and in a way playing to a kind of a stereotype of what you might expect somebody who's, you know, the stereotypical male autistic guy who's, you know, a computer genius kind of thing. So I still think that's a big area that needs to be worked on, but it's certainly, you know, I think that dyslexia, dyspraxia, ADHD, there are other companies that kind of need to make a stand. We saw the thing about, you know, with Universal Music producing the handbook, and the creative industry in particular, I think, has, you know, so much to gain from embracing this and from getting ideas, people who genuinely can think differently, that it just seems that it's just an obvious thing to do. The challenge obviously is kind of a way of, is really about changing ways of working, and perhaps even the way that, I know the world of advertising has become, where there isn't so much creative work as there used to be, in a lot of people's opinions. So, you know, I think that there are particular industries that have so much to gain from this.
And I think you're right, not just to gain, but they're already quite diverse neurologically anyway. And they've just not thought about it or done anything about it. And probably a lot of people within those organisations sat there, as I did at 38, watching a Panorama programme going, oh, I think that's me. And you hear this story so often, it's whether it's, you know, somebody like myself, or whether it's somebody in their 50s who've got a colleague who's going, you know, I've got a son who's autistic, and you have some similar traits, or whatever it may be. I don't know, you've got to be careful what you say to people. But ultimately, there's a lot of people realising, for whatever reason, later on in life, that actually they're neurologically diverse. And I think that's starting to create a lot of pressure within organisations to say, actually, we want you to think about this now. We want you to take some kind of responsibility for the fact that we may need additional support or help.
Absolutely, absolutely. And often, you know, it has to come from the top, really, doesn't it? I think, you know, I was thinking about somebody who I spoke to, a really large organisation whose daughter was dyslexic, and that really inspired him to make sure that that there were processes that could help his neurodiverse staff. Yeah, often it is that it will just need to come from the top, and those kind of personal experiences can have a huge impact. But I think that, yeah, like you say, it can be at any point in your life where you have that aha moment and that, you know, that realization. And it's about having that, you know, that those support structures in place. I was speaking to someone who works in another government department who's in his 60s, I think, and he was saying to me how happy he is being able to work somewhere where the, you know, managers are sympathetic and understand that he may take longer to complete tasks, he may need to work in a slightly different way, but they really are able to get the best out of him. And you know, it's just great to hear that kind of story where he'd had workplace, he had a coach to help him through the challenges that he was facing, and to come out the other end and have that kind of positive experience. Because I think that, you know, a lot of people who are neurodiverse would have had some quite negative experiences at one point or another in their lives. And so I think that finding that right environment, you know, is critical. And if you're an organisation who can provide that, then of course you're going to attract, you know, these, you know, some really talented people who can you know, make an impact and can have a huge effect on a company's bottom line if they're managed and if they're supported in the right way.
How do you think this current crisis that we're in, that we can't ignore, COVID-19, how do you think that will play its part in terms of either improving opportunities for those in neurodiverse are actually having the opposite effect potentially? But what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, it's an interesting one, isn't it? I've seen a few webinars going on about this over the next few weeks that I saw, because it is an area that's obviously really, really important now. And we're seeing that, you know, the people saying, talking about the death of the office and all this sort of thing, which is probably true in a lot of for a lot of organizations in the future. But I think that it depends on the individual, and some people will struggle massively if you're neurodiverse, but a lot of others would thrive. You know, I was speaking to someone who's autistic, and he was saying how much he's enjoyed working from home. He's a lawyer, and he was saying, you know, this is brilliant. Normally, in the world of law, we can't do this. We have to be there. We have to be in the office, and this has given me the space to be far more productive and to really enjoy my work. And I haven't done that for so many years. And it's just brilliant to hear that sort of thing. And from a personal perspective, I feel like I do the best work, the work that requires loads of attention to detail, far better in a quiet environment than I would in a busy office. And I think that a lot of people do share that. I think the challenge really is mainly about, I think, onboarding sort of new people. So you've got new members of staff who are neurodiverse. It's a challenge for anybody starting a new job. But I think that if you're neurodiverse, it can be a huge challenge starting any new job, any new career. And when you need that kind of face time and being in the same place at the same time, that's I think it's a real challenge.
Yeah, and I think that's for a lot of people. I mean, I've got a new member of my team now, mm-hmm. and she's just literally yesterday said exactly that. You know, you feel it when you're a new employee. It takes you a bit of time to kind of onboard and to get used to things and to understand people, and to have to do that remotely, where you're only really going to get access to a small limited amount of people. You're not randomly going to bump into somebody whilst you make a coffee and get chatting with them and realize they're doing some really interesting work. It's not going to happen. So you start to really limit the level of interaction that you potentially get from across the organization. So you live in these little microcosms, these micro worlds. So I think when we return to work, that could be a potential challenge. Oh, well, return to work, the workplace, whatever that looks like, because it may not be it's sat in the four walls. There may be other ways that we need to adapt. And I think especially from my perspective, you know, having ADHD, I like to be with people, but I also get overwhelmed I also, you know, go into hyperdrive, which means at the end of the day, almost collapse. So for me, the balance is good of working remotely and working in an office. But for me, this has not been a real world trial and situation because I've got kids. So that completely then throws everything off the chart.
Yeah.
And so I'm really fascinated when we do get back to some kind of normality, if we look at the data and the stats, what real world effect it's actually had and whether organizations have used the data in a positive way or in a negative way, to inform whether or not we get more neurodiverse people into the organizations that should be employing them or not.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I was speaking to an occupational therapist who through a webinar, was saying that, you know, it may be for some people that the office or whatever it is, is a place where people, you know, where you go for meetings, where you go to collaborate, and that sort of thing. But the actual work itself, the stuff where you actually get down to it, will be done from home potentially. And I think that, you know, for me anyway, and maybe for a lot of other people, that would be a great balance where you do those kind of things, where you still have that collaboration, whether it's 1 or 2 days a week in an office or wherever, and then kind of working from home a few days a week as well, could be a good balance there.
Brilliant. Yeah. So what's next for you, Adam? What do you have on the horizon? What are your plans?
Yeah, so I am, well, when things get back to normal, hopefully, I had been planning to speak at another advertising agency's conference. That was all planned, but it obviously got put back because of coronavirus. I'm also going to be speaking at another conference for an organization that deals with HR. And it's just one of those things where once you kind of open up and speak publicly about neurodiversity, I felt it's had a bit of a snowball effect. I don't know if you had a similar thing, but you know, somebody hears you speak and then you speak somewhere else, and then you could get forwarded, recommended to other people. So it's an interesting time, and it's something that I'm really passionate about. It's something that I feel like I can use my teaching skills in a slightly different area, I suppose, to help companies and to help individuals.
Brilliant. Yeah, no, I feel the same way. And I think we are definitely in a phase of awareness where, you know, did absolutely, we need to continue raising the awareness. I'm finding that more and more rooms that I speak in, specifically in the UK, more and more hands are going up when you mention neurodiversity. So that's good. That means it's working. We're getting somewhere. But I certainly don't think we're where we need to be. And I think there will be a lull of where the awareness gets everybody interested and excited. And then it's actually, we need action then. We need to take some serious action. And that may be the challenging bit. It's been the challenging piece with diversity and inclusion, but it happened. And organisations are now taking it seriously and things are being implemented. And the data's showing, you know, more diverse teams, better performing, etc. So I'm really hopeful that, I mean, COVID has played a strange trick on us, I think, but we'll see how it works out, how we'll feel about it at the end of this year and what the data will look like. But I'm excited by it. It's good to hear you're getting out there and continuing to spread the message. Well done.
So yeah, thank you very much.
No problem. And it's an absolute pleasure to have you on. Thank you. And keep us informed. Let us know what you're getting up to and how you're getting on.
Definitely, I will do. Thank you so much for having me on.
No problem.
You've been listening to Neurodiversity at Work, available on all good podcast hosts. Please do sign up now, like, share, and comment. We'd love to hear from you. Thank you.